Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, July 15th. I'm Ray Graff. Time once again for another edition of the Science Forum on Vox Pop. We have a panel of experts reassembled to field your inquiries. And I got to tell you, we've never had this many scientists in a room before. The collective IQ is 600. Well, no, I'm here too. So 612. The number to call is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. If you have a science question, you can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. This should be fun. The Science Forum, your calls coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call and talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Today, we reconvene the Science Forum, and we welcome your science questions. 800-348-2551 is our number, 1-800-348-2551. If you want to, you can email us as well, and a couple of people have done that already. voxpop@wamc.org is the email address. Again, the number is 800-348-2551. Always great fun to have the Science Forum in action, and even more fun to have a room full of scientists here today, although maybe by the end of the show I won't be saying that. But let's first have our scientists sign in, please.
Ed Stender, SUNY Cobleskill, geology, astronomy, environmental science, and anything Roger can't answer.
I'm Jim Pickett. I'm an organic chemist, mostly retired now.
What do you mean mostly? What do you do, a little pickup work here and there?
Yeah, a little bit.
How do you do pickup work in science?
Consulting.
Yeah.
Oh, I see. So you're driving a nice car now, huh?
No. Same old junk.
Fair enough.
You know, consulting is the 90s word for unemployed, right?
I did not know that. Yeah, that must
I'm
be
a
Roger.
Consultant. Roger Giaboni. I own a company called Rogers High Fidelity. I'm an electrical engineer with an aerospace background.
And you worked for what, NASA and this and that?
I worked for RCA and General Electric, and our customers were NASA and the Department of Defense.
And now you make the tube stuff.
Now we make the tube stuff.
And over here.
No tubes here.
You got no tubes?
No tubes.
All right.
Barbara Brabets. I am a biochemist. I teach biology and chemistry at SUNY Cobleskill. Starting this fall, right now, we are not teaching, which is nice. Oh. This is the quote-unquote summer.
So it is the summer. Even
it
without
is.
Quotes, it's the summer. And you look relaxed. You and Ed look very relaxed today. When does the semester begin?
I think it's the 30th of August.
Thanks for reminding us.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
So classes are filling up. I'm teaching many microbiology labs this coming year.
Oh, that's exciting. Well, enjoy yourself. And we have some emails that came in. Now, over the last several days, the humidity, it's like a jungle. Every time I step outside, the humidity is so high. It's been so wet. And our signal here, our FM signal has been spotty at times, and we're getting a lot of reports from various listeners sort of at the edges of our signal strength. We're saying, what's going on here? And this email came in from Bob. We were going to talk about this anyway. Bob writes, WAMC signal really poor today. According to a link from the station's website, due to the high humidity and high pressure, we and many other stations are falling victim to tropospheric propagation, ducting, if you will. There's nothing WAMC can do to prevent or minimize this. If you're noticing this, you can continue to listen online, which is true. Now, Bob wants us to explain this. How long is this phenomenon likely to last? Who wants it?
Well, I've got two thoughts. The first one is WAMC's signal being poor, if he's in a location where his signal strength is good, isn't necessarily due to tropospheric ducting. It's more due to the fact that there's so much moisture in the air, the trees are wet, so it's path loss. The path loss is probably higher for him than under normal atmospheric conditions.
But, however, we had an email come in yesterday, I believe, maybe the day before, who said, I usually get your station okay, but today I've got a station out of Florida.
Well, and that is the ducting.
Yeah.
That would be the ducting. And the ducting, normally the FM radio communications, which 90.3 megahertz, is considered the VHF spectrum. VHF and UHF signals propagate line of sight under normal circumstances, meaning once you hit the curvature of the earth, they start to decrease in signal strength very rapidly. atmospheric conditions and just some recent reading and Barbara pointing out a couple of points, seems to be mostly humidity and temperature related.
Yep.
Form ducts in the troposphere, okay, which is the E layer, I believe. And those ducts become very good pathways for VHF and UHF communication. So communications or broadcasts that would typically go 25, 35 miles line of sight, we're now getting hundreds of miles. And they're momentary. Those ducts open up for a few minutes at a time. They don't generally stay open.
So you can't really rely on them for long-distance communication.
No, as a matter of fact, that there are communication systems that were designed to operate with that, and they were constantly banging the troposphere for openings so that they could quick data stream and then look for another opening.
Now, Ed, in the green room before the show, you were saying that you were up in Newfoundland, and you actually heard a station, a 5-watt college station out of where? Rhode Island?
Out of Brockport, which is where I used to go. I would sit there and actually hear my old radio station that I used to work at in Newfoundland, St. John's, Newfoundland, because it picked up on one of these scatterings that came off the troposphere.
You know, it's funny. When I was a kid, of course, into the 70s around here, we didn't have cable. I mean, there were had the big TV antennas outside.
Right.
And when I was a kid, we could tell when the bad weather or when the summer storms were going to approach. Channel 8 out of Hartford would come in on my TV, or we would get Channel 67 out of wherever that is in Boston.
Channel 2 in Utica.
Yeah, that way we could get on a good day.
Oh, well, yeah, I was on the other side of the mountains for that one, so that was biggie for me.
This email came in from Susan. Susan writes, explain the daily behavior of UVA plus UVB. Is UVB a peak like a mountain at noon? Is UVA a flat bar across the vertical middle of the mountain of UVB? Or does it follow along roughly the same peak as UVB? I've seen conflicting reports on this, and Susan, I have no idea what I just read. Who wants to answer it?
I can answer that. The UVB is regulated by how much ozone the light goes through.
Okay.
Which is up in the stratosphere.
From the sun.
Just so we're starting, we're talking about solar radiation in the ultraviolet spectrum.
Okay, so UV meaning ultraviolet.
UV, ultraviolet.
And the difference between A and B?
Okay, the B is what will give you sunburn. The UVA can do stuff to your skin, but it doesn't immediately give you sunburn. The UVB, it catches the tail of where ozone absorbs, and it's up in the stratosphere. When the sun is low in the sky, it passes obliquely through the atmosphere, so the path length of the ozone is long, and it gets heavily absorbed. So when the sun is low in the sky, there's very little UVB. UVA, on the other hand, is not absorbed by ozone, and it will track more or less
with the sun,
the visible light. So if it's bright, there's UVA, but the UVB is very closely related to the height of the sun. So yeah, it does. There's virtually no UVB in the morning or at dusk, and it peaks at solar noon. If you want a rule of thumb, if the if your shadow is shorter than you are, you should probably be wearing sunscreen because the sun's high enough in the sky that there's quite a bit of UVB.
Yeah, and to mention as well that UVA and UVB are actually just different sections of the same thing. It's all part of the electromagnetic spectrum that comes out of the sun.
Different frequencies.
Yep. They're just UVA is a longer frequency than UVB. That's really the only difference.
So why then does ozone only absorb?
Because water absorbs certain frequencies better than others, and so the atmosphere is much more transparent to certain frequencies than other ones.
Molecules have resonant frequencies.
Yeah.
Yes.
So the ozone, the peak of the ozone absorption is at much shorter wavelengths. It's kind of just a tail of the absorption that comes in so that it just sucks up the UV light. Basically, if there was no ozone, we would be getting what's termed UVC, which is very damaging to life. can be used to sterilize stuff.
Why a lot of the scientists were freaking out when the fluorocarbons were causing the ozone layer to deplete.
Yeah. How are we doing with that? It's sort of back.
It's building back.
Yeah.
It still has its seasonal fluctuations. In wintertime, it's really tough, but the Arctic, you're not really naked in the Arctic in the winter, but it's down by Antarctic and Australia. It's more of a problem.
Let's take a quick break. It's the Science Forum. If you have a science question, we have four experts in the house. 800-348-2551 is our number. 1-800-348-2551. Email voxpop@wamc.org. We'll be right back. Vox Pop on WAMC, 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. It's the Science Forum today. Barbara Brabets, Ed Stander, Roger Jaboni, and Jim Pickett join us today on the show. And let's go to the phones. Richard in Schenectady. Richard, you're on.
All right. Thank you. Hi, folks. I had three things I was curious about this time, so hopefully I'll be able to ask about two of them anyway.
Okay.
The first one, I was the last caller on your show 2 weeks ago about climate change, and I had less than a minute to go, and you told me, Ray, that we'll have to carry this over to the next time. But I brought up the idea of pesticides, the issue of pesticides, and I'd heard several years ago that the most effective pesticide of insects for agriculture and in general is winter. So is it true that as temperatures get warmer in some areas, insects could possibly survive over the winter months, and much more pesticides would be needed to keep them at bay?
Most of what you said is correct. So winter is a really good pesticide, especially for insects. So let's focus on insects in particular. If you think about ticks, it's not like we all had guinea hens running around in the 1970s eating all the ticks. Ticks just weren't an issue because we were in a period of global cooling and we had colder winters then. So the tick eggs could not overwinter, or we didn't have – the other way you can do it is, even if it's not seriously cold, if you don't have any ground cover, that is snow cover, the wind will also desiccate the eggs so that they're not viable the next spring. I never saw a termite until I was an adult, and I've lived in upstate New York quite a while, and I know termite damage is now an issue in upstate New York. You do have to worry about termites, and even cockroaches in the northernmost cities they're not completely susceptible to winter, but their populations are somewhat controlled by it. So, yes, winter is a pest controller by far, and then there are downstream effects of that. The issue is probably not more pest control, I mean more pesticides, but rather different pesticides. I had viburnum beetle that was on my viburnum, and I went to the Landis Arboretum and talked to Fred Breglia and asked him, what can I do? What can I buy for a viburnum beetle? And he said, really, just pull out all your viburnum now. Just, there's nothing
really
you can do. You know, you can buy this, but they're a hard-shelled beetle, kind of like a Japanese beetle. And they just, the pesticides don't penetrate well because they have that exoskeleton. So for different types of pests, it's really difficult. Then what you'd have to do is poison the plant. And then when they're eating the plant, they ingest the poison that way, kind of a Trojan horse approach to killing the insect. So it may not be more. It may just be different.
And, of course, the other part of this is that nowadays with the monocultures that we've got, the pests that do exist are becoming much, much more of a pest because they're able to take over much larger areas.
Well, and if anybody knows, has worked in public education, head lice, is really resistant to most of the anti-louse medications that you can buy over the counter. They've just been selected unnaturally time and time and time again so that the ones that can resist the pesticides are the ones that live, and then those are the ones that are going to propagate to the next individual who's susceptible to the lice. So, yeah, there's a definite migration of how this is all going to go.
All right, Richard, you wanted one more here?
The second question is shorter. I hear about how we have to worry about a lot of these old lead pipes. because those pipes that leach lead. And I was thinking, isn't the older the pipe is, the less likely it's likely to leach lead? Because it seems like it's not like radioactive things. It seems like after a while that the lead, there wouldn't be any more lead to leach out of them.
Well, actually, a lead pipe is totally made of lead, and so it leaches mm-hmm. until it breaks, which it will do sooner or later, but lead pipes are everywhere. When I bought my house here in Del Mar, the first thing that happened was the lead pipe on the bathtub broke and all the water went into the kitchen.
Ah, but good
these,
times.
These lead pipes, they don't change. They're lead all the way through.
Right, and a contact is only on the inside surface with the water, and so as the pipe dissolves from the inside out, you're always going to have that contact of the lead with the water. One of the big issues with, like, Flint, Michigan, for example, there's corrosion control things that can be done if you have a town water to control the amount of lead. Obviously, taking the lead pipes out of your house is the best solution, and there are federal programs that are out there to do just that because it's a health hazard. But if you want to try to control the potential of lead leach, because even lead was used in some of the fluxes for copper pipes back in the day, and now we use mostly antimony for that, you still can get some lead leach from the flux. What you can do is control the corrosion effect. So you want to control your chloride ion and your sodium ion, and then also your acidic ions, your H-plus ions.
Richard, thanks a lot for the call. The number here is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. Jim Pickett, Barbara Brabitz, Roger Gimone, and Ed Stander here on the Science Forum. And this email from Jules. Now, we talked about tropospheric ducting. When we were in the green room, Roger said, "No, I think you got sporadic E here." And Jules, who is a ham radio operator and longtime listener to this station, said, "I believe you will find that the significant skip openings of the last few days, as high as amateur radio 2 meter frequencies, which are above
150 megahertz,
where WAMC is and where the commercial FM band is, sporadic E, ionosphere activity, and not tropo ducting or scatter. New Jersey contacts with Puerto Rico and Virgin Islands on 2 meters were common yesterday. 6 meters, which is about 50 megahertz. Contacts to Europe from the East Coast and Japan from the West Coast have been common over the last week or so." And that's from Jules, who ought to know.
Hmm.
Isn't that something?
Do you know if wildfire would affect that at all? Because you end up with a lot of ion particulate in the high up in the atmospheres as well. And I could imagine that would allow for some focusing of radio waves.
Why is you getting ions from wildfire?
Just
no.
I don't know about E. I'm just meaning in the atmosphere in general. If the particulate
dust in the atmosphere.
If you put charged particulate in the atmosphere, does that affect it?
Yeah, but what I'm asking is, why do you think they're charged?
Well, because usually anything that's pyrolyzed, that's burnt, is charged.
And it stays charged?
Oh, that's a question. Usually they agglomerate. They kind of glue together.
But what about skip? I mean, we've had some very, very big solar flares just recently, and that's going to break up the ionosphere, so you should have less skip going on. So why are they getting better signals?
Skip is propagation below the ionosphere.
Okay.
So the ionosphere is primarily HF communications, which would be 1.5 megahertz to 30 megahertz. That typically, penetrates the lower levels of the atmosphere and bounces off an ionized ionosphere. And that's primarily what the solar flares disrupts. Okay. Actually, you get the ducting primarily because of environmental issues, but the skip in the lower levels at VHF frequencies. Mm.
Our number here is 800-348-2551, and the email address is voxpop@wamc.org. Rich writes, "I'm old enough to remember when chrome hood ornaments and door handles on cars were actually chrome-plated metal and not plastic. When those cars were standing outside on a sunny day, those parts would get very hot, even hotter than the sheet metal parts adjacent to the chrome parts. This was in spite of how much those parts reflected the rays of the sun. Can you explain that?" And that is from Rich in Ballston Spa.
Pregnant pause.
Well, I'm not sure silver is the highest reflector of solar energy. White would be a better reflector of solar energy.
How about the thermal conductivity of the material?
I would have thought that the metallic, if it's metal.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's chrome plated. I would assume it's some kind of pot metal underneath that then was then chrome plated, yeah, right? So your chrome layer is not going to be the substantial amount. It's going to be whatever the pot metal is underneath.
But it would still have a greater thermal inertia, for example, than plastic.
Yeah. Certainly.
And so it would keep the heat.
And it may have to do with thickness, that the sheet metal is thin. It's going to conduct heat to the cooler side more readily than a thick.
And don't forget, too, when he's talking about the sheet metal being cooler, that's a lot larger surface for it to dissipate heat than the handle itself, which is disconnected or has high resistance paths to dissipate the heat.
Forget about the chrome. How about the vinyl seats on a 67 Pontiac Safari? Try to sit on that in a summer day.
I just rented a car that had air-conditioned seats. This
what?
Is new. Instead of just heated seats, which, of course, here in the Northeast, it's a luxury, this thing had three settings of low, medium, and high air conditioning. So it was kind of – it had little tiny air things
my
in it. And it would,
has
it. Yeah, and
very
it would
nice.
Keep my back from getting sweaty
wow.
in the 110 degrees of Seattle.
You must travel in some very rarefied
well,
company.
I just think they were out of the cheap cars, so they had to give the college professor something a little bit more fancy.
Tell her how much it was per day for the car.
Oh, yeah, it was $90 a day. Because rental cars are more expensive now.
Is that a lot?
Oh, yeah.
I haven't rented a car in a long time.
32 is where I'm like a 32 plus
okay.
tax. That's me.
So basically, if you want the air-conditioned seats, you're going to have to pay.
I was paying for like a Nissan Sentra, and they're like, lady, we don't have those today.
All right. Our number to call is 800-348-2551. Believe it or not, it's the Science Forum. And let's go to Jim in Matamoros. Jim, you're on.
I'm still looking for a quick fix for the poppin' television.
Even though it's
turned off, as long as it's plugged in, you get the alternating current sound coming through to it.
We got to buy you a new TV, buddy.
All right.
Your caps are bad.
It's the capacitors,
it's
right?
It's the capacitors. It's got to be.
Remember that.
Oh, all right.
Oh, my gosh.
All right, Jim, you're going to have to recapitulate this issue for our electrical engineer who was here. Explain it again briefly.
Okay. When the television is plugged in, all of a sudden it just started making a popping noise, which I assume is electrical current coming through it.
Is the popping noise coming out of the speaker or out of the box?
Any picture or anything like that on it.
Is it coming out of the speaker or out of the television unit itself?
Well, probably the television unit. I'm
okay.
not really sure.
Is it a CRT television or an LCD television?
It's a big old Zenith 32-inch tube.
You probably have dust and moisture, and the picture tube in a CRT television has a high voltage anode, which you should not touch for a while, okay, up close to the front of the tube. And that generally, depending on the television design, can run anywhere between 5,000 and 10,000 volts.
Yes, yeah, so don't do that, Jim.
And that picture tube will stay charged for hours, okay? So you want to make sure if you're going to go in there, you discharge that. But at any rate, what you probably have is a dust buildup around the CRT. The dust gets a little bit of moisture. You get a low resistance path, and it starts to break down when the high voltage builds up from the flyback transformer. It's not uncommon.
Have you put like an air blower or something on that?
A can of air.
I think you should go buy a new LCD television.
Yeah, there's no low-def signal anymore. No analog.
It was just acting as a base or an anchor for the new one. But,
well, then leave it unplugged, man.
It's sitting there as a piece of furniture. I'd like to have it working again.
Okay, buddy. Well, thanks for the call. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. Roger Jaboti over at Rogers High Fidelity. I've been to your shop, and I've seen what you do and how you put these tube stereos together. What's the highest voltage you've been zapped with while you worked?
Oh, boy.
Zapped with is, yeah. I've gotten zapped by picture tube, 15,000 volts.
Yeah.
It kind of straightens you out. not much current there, but it definitely gets your attention.
All right, fair enough.
It's the same when you touch your key to your car, for example, when you get a zap
several
from
thousand
that.
Volts.
That's about 10,000 volts.
Yeah.
But it's the amperage that'll kill you.
Yeah, a little amperage.
All right, let's go to Lois in Queensbury. Lois, you're on.
Okay. I have a television, and I have been told by Spectrum that the everything is okay coming in and everything. And so consequently, I bought a new television and it's still doing it. I've had new wires put in from the television to the wall.
What's it doing?
And it's still doing it. What am I supposed to do now?
Why don't you describe what the problem is that you're having, ma'am?
I can't hear the answer.
Well, what exactly is the TV doing, Lois?
Or not doing.
Can you turn your radio down a little bit, Lois? We're hearing you in the background.
Oh, yeah.
That'd be
Should
cool.
Should I shut it off?
Oh, gosh, yes. We'll wait for a second here. And while I do that, are you ready?
Yes.
All right, splendid. All right, now, exactly what is going on with this television of yours?
It will talk along, and then all of a sudden it'll go voop, and then it'll continue as though nothing happened, and then it'll go voop. Huh. Like,
it's only audio, nothing video?
It's all audio.
Mm. So
I bought a new television because the cable company said everything is okay, so I bought a new television. I'm still having the same problem.
Well, that's the best. That right there is the best troubleshooting that you can do. So I think maybe a call to Spectrum to ask them to reset your box.
Or if you have an old box, to get a more modern box.
I did get another box from them. And I've also got all new wiring from my TV to the wall. So I don't know what else I'm supposed to do.
You don't happen to know if you're using the HDMI output or the RF output from the box, do you?
Yeah,
it's
kind of
the HDMI. Whatever.
Okay. Right, HDMI. So you want them to reset that box. It sounds to me like you're getting outages.
They've been here to do that.
Okay, they put a new box in?
I had them. I myself went and got a box, and it was put in.
Okay.
And it's like it still does it.
There's one
Everything
other thing you could do, and that would be to replace your HDMI cable.
Oh, yeah, that could be. Yeah.
The cheapest part.
I replaced it within the last couple weeks, and it's still doing it.
Well, there are different levels of HDMI cables. I mean, there are cheap ones, and there are much more expensive ones.
I did it right from the company.
Okay. All right. I don't think we – honestly, Lois, thank you for calling, but I just don't think there's much we can do here.
Right. I think you're doing all the right things, Lois.
Thanks for the call. 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum. This is an email from Samantha at voxpop@wamc.org. How much at risk am I for weed killer application on pavers outside and on grass insisted on by my condo association?
It depends on the weed killer. There are some weed killers that 15 years ago the scientific literature said were safe for application by your average Joe Blow, and now you really should have professional training before you apply it. And that is because glyphosate, which is known, trademarked as Roundup, doesn't have an effect on human cells in the lab. But what we find is that it affects the bacteria that live in your body that help you digest your food. So there are small pockets of people who've been affected by exposure to Roundup or unintentional or improper application of Roundup. That have developed symptoms like ulcerative colitis, Crohn's disease.
Interesting.
Boy, it does get the grass out of the pavers.
Grass, yes. Plantain, my plantain is Roundup.
You got a plantain?
Roundup ready. Plantain is
weed.
It's a weed.
Oh, I
that
thought
doesn't,
you were talking about the bananas.
Not the banana. It's in the same family, but it's, believe me, there's no bananas here.
Okay.
I'll tell you, we have no bananas. Yeah,
okay,
tell me. Fine. I think I've used this recipe online before, but what I do is I boil water. I put a lot of salt in that water, and I take the boiling water and I pour it on the stuff between the cracks.
Okay, what we're going to do, and maybe this is wrong, but I've talked to the gardeners about this. We put a new sort of a stone walkway in, but it's porous. It's got little stones underneath. Some weeds are growing up. They said get the high-test vinegar at the garden store and put that in.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I'm going to do.
That won't kill the plantain, but it'll kill the grass. I have to do the boiling water torture with the salt water to kill the plantain.
You could make salt potatoes first and then use the water.
Yeah, right.
It's very tasty.
Can I say this is the most demented science forum we've ever had?
People think I'm torturing plants, but hello, I got to get them out of my walkway.
All right, let's take a break here and we'll try to reassess our lives. 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. We'll be back. Hello and welcome back to Radio and TV Repair of the Air. It's 800-348-2551. No, it's actually the Science Forum, and we have four scientists here today, Barbara Brabets, Ed Stander, Roger Taboni, and Jim Pickett, to answer your questions. 800-348-2551. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. This one from Rich in New Jersey. Rich writes, I read in the science section of the New York Times that a big comet is coming. I believe it is said that it took about 1 million years for this comet to do one orbit of the sun. How is this thing still being affected by the sun's gravity when it is way out past our solar system? What makes it take a turn back toward the sun when it hits apogee, 500,000 years worth of speeding at thousands of miles an hour? Isn't it past the point of being affected by the sun, Ed?
Yeah, well, there's a couple things going on there. First is that there are things out in outer space beyond Pluto that affect the orbit of objects. And so when one of these things gets close to another object, it will actually perturbate its orbit and bring it into the inner solar system. Once it starts going into the inner solar system, then gravity of the sun, which of course still affects planets that are well beyond Pluto, start kicking in and it'll bring it in closer and closer.
Okay. This one from Mark. Back in the Dark Ages, many universities across Europe used to teach astrology as a legitimate discipline. We now know, of course, thanks to the work of experts like Galileo and Kepler, that astrology is not science and that the world is not flat. Eventually, when we further develop space travel so as to be able to really visit faraway galaxies, do you think it's possible that, like astrology, much of what is taught today about black holes and other universes could be debunked?
That's cosmology, not astrology.
No. What he's saying is astrology was debunked when Galileo and Kepler and those guys came along. He's
so
saying
will
that
current cosmology be debunked.
Exactly.
Well, we know there's problems with our models. We know that because we have dark matter and there's the talk of dark energy. So the numbers don't add up. We'll find the numbers eventually, and then we'll rewrite the textbooks.
Yeah, effectively, what we've got right now is a cosmology which consists of some pieces of data and a lot of placeholders. And over the time, the placeholders are either going to disappear or we're going to prove that the stuff that we know is not quite right.
Right. I mean, look at what it took to find the neutrino. I mean, that took a lot.
Yeah.
A chargeless small particle of almost no mass. Yeah, that's a toughie, but we found it.
But how long did they suspect it was there before they found it?
Oh, quite a while. 100 years?
Yeah.
All right, we have an email from Alexandria who has an idea about the vroom vroom noise that Lois in Queensbury is experiencing. And Lois, I hope you're listening. Alexandria says, likely could be a grounding issue with feedback, especially if older house with older wiring. Have Lois pick up the landline. If they hear it, then that likely could be an issue.
That's a good suggestion.
You think?
Also, if she has like a 3-to-2 plug converter, like if she has the third grounding wire and she's got one of those little doodads.
No, Roger's shaking his head.
No, I'm just, I'm a team player. I don't want to beat this dead horse.
No.
Okay. All right.
I mean, it's...
Some time.
Is that a problem, though, the 3-to-2 adapter?
Other than where you're going to risk her getting electrocuted by touching the wrong box.
Ah, all right, fair enough.
And then they sue WAMC for that.
All right. So you know what, Lois? Do nothing. All right? that's the bottom line.
Turn the closed captioning on.
Oh, God. Oh, well, 15 minutes to go. Let's go back to the phones. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. Kyle in Utica. Kyle, you're on.
Hi. I'm wondering what the greatest threat from global warming will be in 2050 to the upstate New York region.
greatest threat. Yeah, yep. We're thinking. We have to kind of figure out bad, worse, holy cow.
White supremacists.
Northern, upstate New York, I would say it would be weather extremes.
That's what I would say, too.
The energy in the weather system continues to increase. I mean, the math is very obvious. I know a lot of us locally have just experienced localized storms where there was 4.5 inches of rain in Averill Park yesterday. It's just because there's a lot of energy in the atmosphere that promotes more evaporation, which promotes accumulation of water in the atmosphere, which means it's got to come down. If it comes down in nice over 3 to 4 day period, that's one thing. But if it comes down in an afternoon, then we can't handle it.
I think the other problem we're going to face in upstate New York, honestly, is people from California moving here.
Ah, yeah, that is a problem.
My friend from California, who is not listening, moved out there after graduation 30 years ago.
Yeah.
And has just left California and moved to Kentucky because she's sick and tired of California wildfires, earthquakes, house prices, and the lack of water and electricity.
And that's all she's sick of?
That's, well, we'll see.
All right, fair enough. Let's, before we open that can of worms, let's go to the next call. And Andre in Elka Park, where's Elka Park?
That's good.
Hi, it's like 100 miles north of New York City.
Okay, well, you're on the air, Andre. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks for having me call in. I've heard stories about people getting struck by lightning and then the same person getting struck multiple times. I'm wondering, is there any science related to once you get struck once, are you more likely, or are these just the reckless people that go out in the storms?
These
I
are
love that.
Just basically very dumb people who wind up in the same locations like golfing during thunderstorms.
So years ago, Ed and I did an Ig Nobel Award science forum, and the lightning strike frequency for individuals, the repetition of lightning strikes came up. So we had to read these papers. And it turns out that if you do all the social science of it, it's risky behavior.
Okay. Well, great question, Andre. Thanks for that one. And now we go to Massachusetts, an unnamed place in Massachusetts. Ray, you're on.
Yeah, hi. I'm actually from Belchertown, Mass.
Ah.
And my question is this, that I just recently converted my pool from a freshwater pool to a saltwater pool. And the saltwater chlorinator, I assume, uses electrolysis. And according to the instruction manual, they say that the pool will never consume chlorine. In other words, you'll never have to add more salt unless the salt concentration becomes dilute from water going into the pool. So I just wanted to get an idea of, like, what's the chemistry going on and why won't I ever use chlorine the way I use chlorine tablets, where I put them in the pool, it becomes used, and I have to keep adding more.
You got
to
see the look on Jim Pickett's face right now.
He's like, chemist. Oh, a chemistry question. And both of us are like jumping at it. Let me just tell you, chlorine is not chloride. They're two different elements. And then I'll pass it over to Jim for the rest.
Yeah. So is the electrolysis thing making chlorine from the salt?
I believe chloride is the only thing that they use. So chloride.
Okay. Yeah, I think.
It's just like the ocean. You're in a pool, and the chloride levels are what's keeping the bacteria at bay.
Yeah. So that basically then the more active chlorine molecules or whatever is equivalent to that.
What you would have in a freshwater pool.
But
right.
If you use in a freshwater pool aren't necessary.
Is correct. Okay. So what happens is chlorine is a highly active, quote unquote, poisonous molecule, meaning it's very reactive. And chlorine, the molecule, really wants to be chloride. That's kind of the bottom of the food chain of how a Cl wants to become. Once you're a chloride, you're pretty much bottom of the bottom. Nobody's going to play with you. Nobody's going to react with you. That's why our oceans are salty and they're full of sodium, magnesium, and chloride. They're all the low energy ionized forms that really the only way to get them out of the ocean is through geologic processes. And those are much slower, certainly slower than your pool.
What a cool thing,
though.
A nice saltwater pool.
Yeah.
That's great.
Except for all the maintenance that you're going to have to do from the corrosion effect that we talked about the lead. So that's the one thing about saltwater pools is you really have to have the right equipment that can handle saltwater because you will spend much money trying to chase the corrosion that happens in the plumbing.
Yeah, everything will have to be plastic.
Everything.
Yeah, but one of the nice things about it is that as the water evaporates, the chloride stays in the pool, so you don't have to keep on adding it.
Just like the ocean.
All right, and now to... No, wrong button. I'm sorry there. I'm hitting random buttons now. I've lost the will to live. Carol in East Chatham. Carol, you're on.
Hi there. Thank you. I love the Science Forum. I have two questions, if there's time, but this first question I actually called in and asked years ago, but I forgot the answer. When you bring water to a boil and you want to make pasta, if you put one piece of the pasta in, the water boils up around it. What is that phenomenon and what's it called?
Water.
And then you pour the rest in, and it just, you know, the boil will settle down, and it'll simmer. You turn the heat down.
Right. Water.
It rises up around that one piece.
Go on, Jim. Give it.
All right. Somebody.
No. You got dibs on
Jim,
this one.
Jim, I insist.
Okay. What you've done is the temperature, if you have a nice clean pot, the temperature actually gets a bit above boiling. It gets superheated, though the water becomes superheated. When you add that piece of pasta, the pasta has all these little nooks and crannies, which are really good at creating bubbles. So you drop that into the pot of superheated water and whoosh, you get a lot of boiling all at once coming up from that, and that cools the water. So now you add the rest of the pasta and nothing remarkable happens.
What if I dropped a sponge in boiling water?
Same thing.
Would it be worse? Would it be a big
I don't know with the sponge.
It has a lot of holes.
Very small holes.
What you want are small holes in a relatively
nucleating sites.
Yes, relatively rigid things.
Okay. Bumps.
In fact, in the chem lab, when you're doing things, you add things that are called boiling stones. Which are little pieces of ceramic or other material that you throw in so that you don't superheat the water.
You get the same thing, for example, in a microwave if you're not careful.
Right, like
heating
water for tea.
And then you put some tea inside and the thing boils all over the place
reason.
And if you've seen MythBusters, they do the Mentos and the diet soda.
Yeah.
So you've got, instead of it being superheated, what you have is super saturated with CO2, with carbon dioxide, the gases within the soda.
Yeah.
Then you drop the Mentos, which has lots of nooks and crannies, flavor kernels, and those nooks and crannies are nucleation points for the explosion of releasing all of that CO2 at once.
Now, what if I dropped Alka-Seltzers? I'm a big fan of Alka-Seltzer.
Same thing will happen.
Yeah? Okay. Carol, you had a second question?
If I turn on the fluorescent light, and it's very humid, it won't go on. I turn it on and off a little. I leave it on. I can sometimes see a little light at the end of the tube. If I leave it on a while, turn it off, turn it on again, it'll light up. As soon as the humidity drops, it just goes right on.
She's got, you're getting low resistance path in the fixture. The glowing you're seeing at the end is, it's an old style fluorescent light, and it's got filaments in it on the end. And what happens is that those filaments are energized with a very high voltage transformer in the fixture. And when it's very humid, that high voltage is finding an easier path to short rather than ionize the fluorescent tube.
Yeah, probably right down the glass tube.
Either down the glass tube or down the metallic housing, one or the other.
Yikes.
You can test that just by taking the tube and drying it, just the outside of the tube. Try drying it first and then run it and see
when
what happens.
When it's turned off.
It's turned off, yes.
All right. Well, Carol, thanks a lot for the call. Quickly to Nancy in Walden. Hello, Nancy in Walden.
Hello. I had one question, but now I have two after that last call.
Tremendous.
I teach school, and I always start off the year with some cups filled with water and some with salt in the water, and we watch it evaporate. And the salt water always evaporates slower, but then also I draw a line where the water level was, and when the water is fully evaporated, they have to predict whether the salt is going to evaporate with the water or not. That's the purpose of the experiment. And the salt is always above the water line. Mm-hmm. So the water evaporates, and the salt is all crystallized on the side of the cup above the water line. Now, I tell my kids that it's because the water tries to evaporate, and the salt is part of it, and then the salt just becomes too heavy and falls out of the evaporating water. So number one, is that
correct that I'm telling them.
Not quite, but the evaporation always takes place at the surface, right? You don't have evaporation in the middle of the water. It's always at the surface.
Mm-hmm.
So the vapor pressure is only when you're in contact with the air. So anybody else?
So that the crystals will form there. But then as you get further evaporation, once you get some crystals on the edge of your container, the water level drops more. The water will get wicked up those crystals and evaporate there. So you will favor evaporation and crystallization along the sides of your container.
Right. It's all capillary action at that water surface.
So it will actually, in some instances, climb right out of the container because it'll continue to wick up the sides and evaporate at the top.
Right, and you can see this not with salt water, but this won't be good for your classroom, but say with a good glass of whiskey, if you have a high-proof whiskey,
you got
the tumbler, you're going to get the evaporation at the surface, but you can also see the climbing up the edge, and then it evaporates up the edge.
Oh, my heavens.
Yep. That's the ethanol alcohol leaving.
Go ahead, Nancy.
So it's like a building blocks. It's building a little stairway up the side of the cup, and that's why it goes above the water level, because as it's building the crystals, the water wicks it up.
Exactly.
Is there a surface tension effect, too, between the cup and the salt water?
Well, all capillary action is a surface tension effect.
Yeah. So there'll be some of that. But yeah, I've seen cases in which it climbs right up and gets open. Basically, then you get the salt overflowing surface. Overflowing the cup.
All right, Nancy, thanks a lot for the call. We have about a minute here. This email from Will in Kingston. I love the show. Can somebody speak to the range of quality and durability of vacuum tubes? I'm a guitar player, use vacuum tube amplification. I've read that older tubes, such as those manufactured by GE or RCA for military purposes, are worth spending the extra money on, because they typically will last longer than modern tubes, the so-called new old stock. And that is from Will in Kingston. We only have about 30 seconds.
Yeah, I've been in this business too long to say that what you're hearing, you don't really hear. It's, you know, so if he hears the value in a new old stock tube versus a Russian-made tube, which is primarily where the tubes come from, then he should spend the money. Are they built better? Some may be. There are military versions of tubes that were commercially available that are built for higher levels of shock or temperature extremes.
Yeah.
And they are more rugged.
Okay.
But stay away from the Chinese tubes. They're generally not very good.
All right. Well, thank you for that, ending the show on that, Roger. Did you want to follow up, Ed?
No, I don't want to say another
thrown
thing.
Off the air or whatever.
Roger's high fidelity.
Okay. Thank you all for being here. Once again, you start school, Barbara, when?
Yeah, about a month and a half.
That's me too.
Exciting stuff. And Ed, you too, huh? And what classes are you teaching?
I'm teaching geology and astronomy.
That's very exciting. Jim, it's back to the, where do you go, the dog track during the retirement?
If there was a dog track close,
I guess there aren't anymore. That's right.
That's a problem. Same thing with Hi-Li, you know.
Roger, good luck. Get back to the shop, yeah?
Thank you.
All right, thank you guys for being here. Support comes from Waldorf School of Saratoga Springs, focused on academics, music, art, and movement. Introducing Within Reach, a new sliding scale tuition model, waldorfsaratoga.org for details. Now I'm thinking about Jim going to the Hi-Li match. Hudson Valley Shakespeare Fest. Hudson Valley Shakespeare's 2021 season with in-person and stream performances of The Tempest and the most spectacularly lamentable trial of Ms. Martha Washington through September, hvshakespeare.org. Once again, thanks to Barbara Brabitz, Ed Stander, Jim Pickett, and Roger Jaboni for being here. Thank you for listening. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Susie Chekai took the calls. And tomorrow on the program, oh my heavens, you know, we'll talk beer, we'll talk cider, Josh Whelan of Nine Pin will be here, and the folks from Fort Orange Brewing will be here. So we'll bring a powerful thirst and join us tomorrow at 2. And if you need a reason to drink, stand by for the Capital Connection.